left last week, but I'm going to do a quick recap. I'm not going to go much into the historical part of it. I want to spend more time in the biblical part of it, but took a longer intro last week to talk about the historical aspect of it. So we have a trailblazer, that's William Carey, who wrote this book, and that's an image of the front page of his book, the cover page of his book, An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Hidden. So that's a long title, but it conveys the idea. And he is advocating, he's defending, he's lobbying it, if you will, with the church, and especially his church, which are the particular Baptists. They call particular Baptists, the word particular meaning independent Baptists of England, that they should create a society that would endeavor means to reach people that have not been reached by the gospel. And he did that through many years, but he published his book after collecting data from the whole world. And the first part of the book is theological, is biblical. The second part of the book is like the numbers of the world population, the main countries, and how many Christians are there. If there are Christians, how many churches. All that he could collect through years and years of research, he published. And the second part of the book is to make a point that there is a lot less Christians than the European society thought so. So he brings up the number, and by the number that he brings, Christians are less than one-third of the population of the world in his time. And this shocked some people because they thought kind of like, okay, I mean, we're not the whole world is Christian, but the majority of the world is Christian, right? And that is before, of course, television, radio, cell phones, and all of that. Information was not that widespread. It was in time that most people didn't go to school and were uncultured, so many didn't know even to read and write. So people generally thought that, you know, the world is fairly Christian. And Carey brings the numbers and says, look, the world is not at all fairly Christian. And he faces a lot of opposition, as we read. So, faces a lot of opposition. First opposition is personal. Can you just go, forward? Yeah, one more. So, the first opposition is personal because he is a shoemaker. So, he is kind of a part-time pastor, full-time shoemaker. And he belongs to the particular Baptist. He doesn't even belong to the good old Anglican Church, which is the main church, the strong church in England. So he's not respected as a theologian by the Anglicans, or a pastor for all that matter. By that time, he's allowed to be. A few years, 150 years before that, you couldn't even be a pastor if you were not ordained by the Anglican Church. It was a crime. It was like practicing medicine in our days without having a medical school diploma. So to preach in those days without having an ordination by the Church of England was a crime. And that's why John Bunyan spent 13 years in jail. That was his crime, to preach without being ordained. And in the times of William Carey, there was some peace settlement that independent churches were allowed as long as they didn't challenge the main church. So that's why this group called Particular Baptists were formed. There was also a group of Presbyterians, of independent Puritans. And so first thing is that he was not respected by who he was. Like who are you? A guy that fixes shoes and learns Greek. I mean, and he did learn a lot of the biblical languages, because later in his life, he will translate the Bible into Hindi from the original languages. So he will start by the New Testament, and he will get done a good chunk of the Old Testament, and he will count with helpers too. But he got very good in Greek, in biblical Greek. The second objection that has been done, it's the next slide, is this. He says, it has been objected that there are multitudes in our own nation and within our immediate spheres of action who are as ignorant as the South Sea savages, and that therefore we have work enough at home without going into other countries. So the other objection that he faced is like, look, there's enough people in our own country that is not Christian. So he will respond. He responds that way. Our own countrymen have the means of grace and may attend on the word preached if they choose. They have the means of knowing the truth, and faithful ministers are placed in almost every part of the land. But with them, the South Sea savages. It's not very politically correct according to today's standards, right? But, all right, the heathen. Also not very politically correct. But with them, the heathen, the case is widely different, who have no Bible, no written language, which many of them have not, no ministers, no good civil government, or any of those advantages which we have. Pity, therefore, humanity, as much more and much more Christianity, call loudly for every possible exertion to introduce the gospel amongst them. So you see that he's saying that they have no civil government and no the advantages that we have in Europe or they had in Europe. So what does Carey believe about the gospel? He believes that the gospel is a transformative power. That by believing in the gospel, those savages, those barbaric societies will be totally changed, because Christianity brings an ethic, brings a certain morality, and Christianity will change. So, finally, the society was formed in 1794. You can fast forward a couple slides, one more. And so, 1794, the society is formed, and in 1795, William Carey with 8 other men will go to India. Now, William Carey's effort in India was not easy. First, he had to really learn the language, which he was already trying to learn in England. And during the voyage, we took 8 months of sea, in the sea, pretty much, through storms and all sorts of things. And they were smart enough that William Carey said, look, if we travel all in the same boat and this boat sinks, then the mission fails. So we're going to do this. We're going to be traveling in different boats. So we're going to do in teams of 2 or 3. And that's how they did. I think they traveled in 3 boats. So it was like 3 and their wives. And then I think there were like 2 that were single. So it was like 3 and a single, another couple and a single man, and then other couples. And they travel with the Bibles and all the stuff in different boats, because if one of them would sink, at least the whole mission endeavor wouldn't be lost. And also, they were also bringing with them the money that they had collected. It was not, bank wiring was not an easy thing in 1795. So, and none of them perished during the trip. All of them got there. One of the wives had a miscarriage, but it was very, very difficult to do this. And then Carey himself would lose 2 wives in the field, would lose children in the field. He would get sick. A lot of challenges would face him, but he moved on. Why is William Carey moving on? He tells us, and that's the next slide. He says he believes that the Lord Jesus Christ, a little before His departure, commissioned His apostles to go and teach all nations, or, as another evangelist expresses it, go into all the world to preach the gospel to every creature. So he says, this commission that Jesus gave to the apostle has not been fulfilled. So there are two important things which are the base of what we believe today and what we do missions. And that's a given to us. But it was not in 1792. First, is that there is a commandment there, a commission. Different than a commandment, he uses on purpose the word commission because commission involves a task. A commandment is a moral order, a moral imperative from the Lord, like love your brother, like do not kill, like do not give false testimony. So it's not a commandment, but is a commission, meaning a task. So he's saying, and it's a task for all the church at all times. There's the first point. This is a given for us today. So everyone reads Matthew 28, Mark 16, and they say, yeah, this is for us. People would even say, like, we're all missionaries and everyone should be a missionary, which is not correct, in fact. But we have this sense of missions today, in a sense. And we have a little bit of this urge of missions. At least a good part of Christians do. But they didn't have. And people were not. Matthew 24, he is giving his eschatological sermon about when the things of the end will happen, and he's talking that there will be, world events, and he says, and the love of many will grow cold, and there will be a lot of apostasy. But on verse 14 of Matthew 24, he says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. So, the end will come only when the gospel is preached. So, these two basic premises of William Carey is what we take as the base. It's pretty much a given this day. That the commandment to go into all the world and preach is a commission for the church at all times. It was not just for the apostles, it's for the church at all times. And second, that this has not been fulfilled yet. So let's look at these two texts. So we were looking at Mark 16 last week. And just coming back, Stephen, a little bit, the main verb there is the verb proclaim, which is here, right? So this is the verb proclaim. This is the imperative. The verb go is not in the imperative form. It's an auxiliary verb which draws the force of imperative, but the main commandment in Mark 16:15 is proclaim or preach. proclaim and preach. And this, we ended last week talking about this, involved verbal communication of the gospel. So Mark 16, verse 15, it says, "Go into all the world and proclaim the gospel to the whole creation." So this is the commandment. Go into all the world and proclaim. So this is very important for us because the commandment is not to go only, but to proclaim. And of course, to proclaim into the whole world, to all creation, we have to go. It is necessary to go. So, yes, we can move forward. So, the action is to proclaim by going. But going is just instrumental. You go, but you go to proclaim. That is. And the best way of saying this is together, right? So, is proclamation is the main word. And we looked at these texts last week, and we saw that the gospel cannot be preached if not with words. You know, that motto of preach the gospel, if possible, with words, a Franciscan motto, actually. It's very pretty and very nice, but not entirely true. Because Buddhists do a lot of goodwill and a lot of loving. Hinduists, in their own way, do it as well. And they would talk about love of the neighbor, and they would talk about respecting and forgiving. But only when the word Jesus Christ is mentioned is that there's the beginning of the gospel. The word Jesus Christ is fundamental for us, because after all, we are Christians, followers of Jesus. So this is the commission. The content is the gospel. And Mark 1:1, Mark says, this is the gospel of Jesus Christ. So when it gets to chapter 16 and the readers of Mark read that, basically what Mark is saying is like, look, I have a very nice, concise report or presentation of what the gospel is. Is about Jesus Christ. So, tell others what I'm telling you. That's pretty much what it is. And the target is geographical in one sense, because it's into all the world and to all creatures, all creation, meaning all creatures, which is a common Hebrew idiom saying every person on earth of all kinds. So blacks and whites and Asians and all kind of different people. Slaves, noble, poor, is a very inclusive way of saying every human person in the world. And it talks a bit about the individual dignity that every human being created in the image of God has and should listen to the good news of the Creator's salvation through His Son, Jesus Christ. Now, on verse 16 of Mark, Jesus adds something very interesting that we are going to kind of pick up from that on today. He says, "Whoever believes and is baptized will be saved, but whoever does not believe will be condemned." So, you go into all the world, you preach the gospel to every creature. All right. Now Jesus, after have given them the commandment, is going to talk to them about the results and the response that they're going to have. And what are the two responses that the gospel will have? Jesus is addressing here in verse 16 is, those who believe and are baptized will be saved. But what is the second answer? But whoever does not believe, whoever does not believe. So, Jesus makes it clear that there are two possible answers to the preaching of the gospel. Some will believe and be baptized and be saved. Others won't believe. So my dear brother and sister, every time that you speak of the gospel to someone, there will be one of these two answers. If you're talking to the gospel, if you're speaking or preaching, or however you want to take it, sharing the gospel with someone that is not a Christian, there will be two answers. Only these two. One will believe, and maybe another will not. There are only these two. And this is very important for us to understand, even when we do this, and even when the missionary does, because the missionary must understand that the measure of his success is not the believing part. The success of the missionary or the mission doesn't lie in how many believe. And that's why the church shouldn't be concerned about number of conversions. It's good to hear the numbers. If there were some, we want to know about them. But a mission is not more successful because a lot of people were converted than in relation to another mission in which just a few people were converted. What is the mission should be, how the mission should be measured? What is the bar? The bar is go into all the world and preach. But naturally, there will be some who will believe, and there will be some who will not. And by your own personal experience, where would you put your baskets if it was just a mathematical question here? More people will believe, or more people will not believe? Will not believe. Okay, that's mathematical, but can we be biblical too? Remember when Jesus spoke about the two doors? You remember that text? He says, there are two doors and two ways. One is narrow and the path is difficult. The other one is wide and the path is, straight. What does he say in relation to the wide door, straight path? And many will enter through it. But what does he say about the narrow one? Few. That was Jesus' words. So you and I, we know that. Jesus taught us. He said, look, more people will reject than people will accept. And when we look at the population of the world, we know that this is a reality. This is a reality. Jesus was not being pessimistic. Why Jesus was not being pessimistic? Because of John chapter 10, when he says, I know my sheep by name, every one of them, and I call them, and they come. Remember in the song of the suffering servant in Isaiah 53, how it ends? It ends like this. And he will see his work and he will be satisfied. Because none of the elect predestined to salvation will be lost. So no word is wasted. No seed is wasted. Also because God has many purposes. But the reality is that there will be a good number of people who go through the wide door and only a handful or a few that will go through the narrow door. That is worldwide all right? It doesn't mean that in a certain local place, the majority could be converted. And you're like, oh, that's not biblical, the majority convert. No, it's not. We're not saying that. I know, actually, a missionary, and later I even study under him, and now we are kind of colleagues in the same mission program in Brazil. He was a missionary in Africa, in the deep jungles of Africa. He was ministering to a tribe, I think, which was like Congo region, and if I remember well, which was called the Kokombas. And there was, of course, there's the middle of the jungle, no electricity, no nothing. He lived in a hut with his wife and daughter. But this people were not reached, meaning no missionary had been to them, been to their tribe. They didn't have a written language, so he created a written language for them. He translated parts of the Gospels. It started the translation of the Bible. This is a Brazilian missionary, by the way. And he started the translation of the Bible to their language, to the Kokombas, and he became very fluent in their language, and he speaks their language. And through almost, I think, was 15 or 18 years of work, after initially a lot of rejection, a lot of hard work, the majority of that people, not to say everyone in that people, became Christian. So today, the Kokombas are a Christian tribe. They have adopted officially Christianity as their religion. Their tribal leader is a Christian, and they have adopted. So now they have built churches. So the work that he did is unbelievable. Unbelievable. This people is a people that is of a few thousand. I think they're like 6,000. It's the number of the people. And of course, he didn't evangelize them all. He evangelized the one group, and then the other group, and this group went into other distant places. And now the Kokombas, the whole people, that language, that region, is Christian. The work that he did was amazing because he taught them to how to plant some things like manioc and other things, how to gather them. He helped them to take to the market and sell in the market, and they started making better money and improving their lives. It's unbelievable the work they did. It's one of those astonishing works that he did. But that is not the norm. I know another faithful guy, and I've shared with a few of you, I think with John Simon. I know another guy that was in Morocco. He was arrested, beaten, and he ran through, escaped through the night, crossed the border. Then he was sent to Afghanistan. He suffered a murder attempt. His driver was killed. He was shot in the arm. And then today, now he is in northern Iraq. And he works with little children in a refugee camp, a Kurd refugee camp. This is another Brazilian guy. If you tell him, like, the church that he is planting there in northern Iraq has a handful of just people that go, and he doesn't even know if these people are converted. He's working with one of the teachers that work in the camp, and he's almost sure that she has converted. And you think, like, okay, so Lidório, the other guy that was among the Kokombas, he was successful, right? And while Albano, this guy that is in northern Iraq, he was like, not very successful, right? How could we say that? One has a story of success, the other has a story of beaten, of assassination attempt, and he's worked with pre-K, in a pre-K, and you're like, really? Yes. So through the school, he has access to the parents, and he ministers, helps, and all. But, you know, it's Iraq, so there's always risks. There's always... So you say, like, who's the one guy that God used here? Both. Because it's not by the success rate that you are approved. right? And maybe someone, a more skeptical brother, would say to Albano, like, maybe the Lord is saying that you should stay in Brazil and stop, you know, because you have not a good track record of being well accepted, brother. But he's there doing the work that he believes God sent him to do. Because some will believe and some will reject. And the preaching of the gospel will always be like that. And we must understand. And we must understand more than all. And that's one thing that I, when I'm teaching my students, we go at length and we look a lot of texts. It's like, I say to them, like, look, when they reject the gospel, don't take it personally, right? Because they're not rejecting you. Right? Because one thing that we makes us to have a little bit of be shy to share the gospel is like, and if the person rejects and all. Look, if the person rejects, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting salvation and they're rejecting Jesus Christ, which is sad. But don't take it personally. It's not about you. It's not about us. Right? Not about me. It's about Jesus Christ. And that is the faithfulness of the missionary. The faithfulness of the missionary, which we'll see when we get into Matthew. So let's go into Matthew here. So now Matthew 28, which is, in the mission manuals, the text per se that is called the Great Commission. So usually in the mission manuals, Matthew 28, 18 to 20 is the text that when they refer the text of the Great Commission. People usually are referring to Matthew 28, you know, using that terminology that Carey brought to us. He is the one that gave us that idea of a commission. And in the mission manuals and mission books, it is described as the Great Commission, right? The Great Commission. So Matthew 28, 18 to 20, it says this. And Jesus came and said to them, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all the things that I have commanded you. And behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. We're not going to have time to explore this text in depth for the time that we have. I spent, usually in my, when I'm teaching there, I spent a whole morning just in Mark and Matthew, like 4 hours of class, just in Matthew and Mark, going really deeper into it. But one thing that we see in Matthew is that the commandment is a lot bigger than in Mark, right? So that goes with Matthew. So Matthew wrote after Mark. Mark was the first gospel to be written. And Matthew contains more than 80% of Mark, literally. So he plagiarized Mark. And he added some things. So Matthew is a more developed account of Mark. And that was okay. There was nothing wrong with this. So Matthew, for instance, adds Jesus' birth that Mark doesn't have. And we'll add some more context and some more information. Matthew is writing to Jews, and that's why he quotes the Old Testament a lot. Mark almost never quotes the Old Testament. Matthew quotes the Old Testament a lot. And so the commandment here is a bit different. So looking at Matthew here, we have three verbs. So first, we have the verb, go, therefore, and make disciples. Make disciples. And the other two verbs that we have is baptizing them and teaching them. So, again, as I told you, when we look at a text and we look at the verb, you have the center of the text. So you can look who is the subject, what does it entail, and that's how you get a sense of it. So looking at the verbs is always a good exercise. So go, therefore, and make disciples. That's what it is. But before the commandment, we have something that Matthew adds that is substantial. He says, all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. And that makes a whole lot of difference. Because in Mark, we have like Jesus goes straight to the command. But here, he gives them something that they could rely on. It's like, look, now I am in power. Now I'm glorified. I have all authority. All authority is mine. And I'm commanding you to go. So the authority element is fundamental here. It's the next slide. So the commission given by Jesus is based on the authority he conquered by his victory over death. We read that in Philippians, that he humbled himself, he emptied himself, he was obedient until death and death of cross. And then the Father exalted him and gave him a name that is above every other name. It's authority. So Jesus was exalted to the right hand of the Father. This expression that we have in our Apostles' Creed, that he died under Pontius Pilate, was crucified, resurrected on the third day, and was raised into heaven. I'm just quoting here, translating from Portuguese, by the way. And is seated at the right hand of the Father, right? Isn't it what it says? So, he is seated. Why do we include that in the Apostles' Creed? Why do we have that? Because that's very important. When we say, he's seated at the right hand, and you say, what do you mean? It means that he has all the power, that he is in control. So he's seated at the right hand of the power. So those who fulfill the commission to go in the authority and power of Jesus Christ. I mean, those who fulfill the commission go in the authority and the power of Jesus Christ. So that's a very important thing. There is a power in the authority of Jesus. Because look, ultimately, what will decide the destiny of the whole world? It's the preaching of the gospel. Didn't we read Matthew 24:14? In this gospel will be preached to all nations, and then the end will come. So what holds the Antichrist to be manifested? What is holding the Antichrist to be manifested? The preaching, objectively speaking, is the preaching of the gospel to all nations. Do you want to see? Go back to Matthew 24. Let's read the 14. And then says, and this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to the nations. And then the end will come. Now jump to 6:15. So when you see the abomination of the desolation spoken by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, that's the Antichrist, by the way, then let those who are in Judea, and he's going to talk. So the abomination of the desolation is the manifestation of the Antichrist. So the Antichrist comes after one event. What is this event? The preaching of the gospel to the whole world. So this is the one thing that needs to happen so the Antichrist is manifested. So missions is an imperative that is done upon the authority of Jesus Christ to end the world. So if we pray as we are taught to pray, thy kingdom come, which is, we pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. So, if we pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, we must fulfill the mission commission, the mission work. Because that's the only way in which the kingdom will come and God's will be implemented to the whole earth. The Antichrist will be manifested, he'll be defeated, and the end will come. So, missions has everything to do with the end of time. It's done in the authority of Jesus. In the authority of Jesus. So what is the commission here in Matthew? So I'll just talk about this quickly, but go, I don't want to spend a lot of time. So when we compare, this is Mark, the Greek text of Mark, and when we look at the Greek text of Matthew, what do we see? We see that it has the same grammatical structure. So Matthew got the text of Mark, and he used the same grammatical structure. He used an imperative and used a participle, but he changed the verb. So what is the verb in Mark of the imperative? It's go and preach. In Matthew, it's go and make disciples. So in Matthew, we have preach being replaced by make disciples. And by the way, that's a single word. All right? It's this word here. It's matheusate. It's one word. It's simply disciple. Go and disciple people. So the commandment is a lot more inclusive because to preach, you just, you know, get the little fruit box, you put it over there, climb on top of it, and say, "Hello, folks, I'm here in the name of Jesus Christ to talk to you about the good news that is in the gospel." That is proclaiming. That's Mark. But discipleship is not something that you do just in a wide public talking like that. Discipleship is spending time with someone to break the details of the gospel with them. So Matthew is widening the commandment. He is teaching us that to do missions, it's not enough that we have an itinerant, a preacher that goes from village to village to village to village. That is not all that it is. It is necessary to spend time with people. Missionary is supposed to preach, and he can go from village to village. But then he has to turn around and go from village to village to village, and go around from village to village to village. The American missionaries that went to Brazil, they did that. I told you a little bit about the story of my great-grandpa that was evangelized by American missionaries. And that's how they did. So he was in a part of the South that, you know, have no, I mean, those days, it was like the end of 18th century, it was like just horse by horse, and they were like pretty much tracks. So the roads were, you know, very bad dirt roads. It was wagon, and some parts that were not even road, you were trailblazing. So the missionaries would come and stay at his farm and preach around and then move on. And then 2 or 3 months later, they would come back again and stay at his farm and disciple and teach the Bible and stay for 2 or 3 days, sometimes a week, and then move on. And they would go, and they would be going around and doing that, which is what this is. Of course, if you have the time to speak just once to a person, I mean, you should take the opportunity. You won't have time to disciple that person. But discipleship is the real goal of missions. To disciple someone, what do you have to do? You have to know the culture, you have to know the language, you have to live in the place, you have to build relationships. And that drives a lot of how we do missions today. That's why we don't send someone who will go there on vacation, you know, during the summer months and do something and come back. That kind of mission has a place, and I call it the support of missions, what we call short mission trips. It is great. It is important. It gives a great relief to the missionaries. It brings the support of missions, but it's not the core mission. The core mission is that we sent one of us to go into that culture, into that country, that place, that will live as one of them, will speak their language, understand their culture, and will be able to disciple. Because to disciple requires time. It's a 101. It involves engagement. How do we know? Because this word is used by Jesus for what he was doing with the 12. How long did he spend with them? 3 years. 3 years preparing, discipling. And they were living with Jesus. Day and night. They learned by practice. They learned by teaching. And that's what the word disciple means. And this is the core commandment in Matthew. So what is the grammatical structure of Matthew? It is this here. And it helps you. So, go is only secondary to make disciples. Can you just go through the all of them? All of them, put the other ones too, if you can, please. Yes. So, the core commandment is make disciples. That is the only imperative in the whole text. The other verbs are in the participle. And participle, I told you already, it's a secondary verb and it's an auxiliary verb. So what do they mean? They mean that to make disciples, you have to go. But if you ask, how do I make disciples? You make disciples by teaching and baptizing. So teaching and baptizing are the two auxiliary verbs that clarify what making disciples entail. So understand? So the next slide will give us an idea. And we're not going to go through this today, so we'll pick from this point next week, talking about Matthew. So first, make disciples is the imperative. Right? The imperative. So, let's see Matthew 13:52. So, Matthew 13:52, the text that is there. And I'll stop here and making disciples, alright? So, we will look into the rest next week. 13:52, it says, and he said to them, therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out of his treasure what is new and what is old. So when he says, therefore, the scribe who has been trained, it means the scribe who has been discipled. So this word discipled, it means being schooled. So to disciple someone is kind of to put them through a school. That's what a scribe had to do. Remember, the scribes, they were the PhDs, the doctors of the law. And he had a master, and he would learn his craft, pretty much, which was, for the main part, copy Moses' law. The main work of a scribe was to copy Moses' law. But also, he was, besides copying Moses' law, he was also a teacher himself. So it's like a little bit like training martial arts. You start with the white belt, and then you move to the yellow belt, and you're going to move. And when you get the black belt, you become yourself a master. So you can have other guys and teach other guys, right? That's pretty much how kind of it is. So you start from the bottom and you go up and you become a scribe. And then you, who was trained, who were a disciple until that point, become a discipler. That is this process that Jesus is describing here in this verse. And he's saying that then he brings out of his treasure. What treasure is this? What is he learned, his knowledge. That's his treasure. What is the treasure of a scribe? It's what he learned. It's what is here. So he brings out of his treasure new things that he's contributing and the knowledge of the old things that through generations were passed into him. So that's what discipling means. So to end here today, we could look at Acts 14:21 as well. So Acts 14:21, a last text here. 14:21 says, when they had preached the gospel to that city, had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch. So it's talking about Paul. So what was Paul's first engagement? Was preaching. But it didn't stop there. Preaching was just the beginning. He preached, people got interested, and he made disciples. Right? It says, and when they had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples. Preaching is the instrument for that, but discipling requires a little bit more time. And that's how Paul did. He spent the time that he could and the time that he had on each city, until he could leave someone in charge of discipling them and he would move on, or he could train some local people to now teach and lead the rest, because that was part of discipling. Alright? So, we're going to end here. What does that really mean for missions? It means, dear brothers and sisters, that we should send into the field prepared people. We should send into the field disciples who Jesus sent into the world in his time. The 12 initially. Who were the 12? They were the best that the church had in those days. And it's interesting that sometimes in our time, a pastor who has had a hard time in certain church, and he has been not very successful in a certain churches and all, and someone will tap him and say, hey, maybe you try, church planting or mission or something. Like, I've heard that a couple times. I'm like, no. Maybe that's his gift. But that has to be manifest and confirmed by many other means. It's not like, oh, because you didn't do so well in here, maybe go to the mission field. Because, forgive me for the graphic representation, you should not send to the mission field the leftovers. We shouldn't send to the mission field those that don't fit here and keep the best in here. How are we preparing, really, those that are there if we're not sending people who can disciple them? So there has to be, indeed, a great scrutiny of those that go in our name. If we send someone, we must send prepared people. And I tell them, my students, very well. I tell them, like, the mission field is not a place for you to acquire holiness. A mission field is a place that the holy ones will be sent to be used and tested and then grow. But a mission field is not a place that you go to improve your Christian life. We should send to the mission field the prepared people, because it is rough. The mission field is rough. It's no joke. Most of us that are not called, all of us that are not called, would not survive in a mission field. Would not survive. And I told you that I have this experience because, being a teacher of missions for 14 years, many good young men and young women that have a heart for missions but were not called for missions ended up in the field and it didn't work well for them. Because the mission field is tough. We must send people that are prepared. And prepared people, we should, to go into the mission field. It doesn't mean that we should pick the ones that are prepared and send them, but it should mean that we should prepare those that feel called to go and send them. And if we're sending those that are prepared, for us who are here, what does it mean? it means to give them all the support that we can. All the support that we can. Financial, with our prayers, with materials, whatever they need. Look at guys like William Carey. He's a guy that translated the Bible to Hindu. He's a guy that had a knowledge of Greek and Hebrew enough that could speak English and other languages, that learned Hindu enough to publish the Bible in Hindu. And the translation that he did, still used to this day, by the way. It's a bit outdated in some things, but the language is considered to be flawless, to be considered like a skilled translation, masterful translation. So, it's that kind of prepared people that we should send. And that's the kind of mission that we should be doing. If you don't have any questions or comments, I'll close in prayer.